This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, it's time for Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom. We are going to start today with Dr. Andrew Clark. He is the chief archaeologist for the State Historical Society of North Dakota, and he is the co-author and a presenter on the topic Archaeological Perspectives on Warfare on the Great Plains. It's part of the Visiting Scientists series, and this presentation is coming up this Tuesday, the 21st at 7 p.m. at the North Dakota Heritage Center. Andy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So as I understand it, you are focusing on the time period between AD 1000 and 1750. But before we even get into all of what's happened in just that time period, I want to talk about the definition of warfare, because there can be conflict, there can be a raid, there can be a massacre. When you use the word warfare, what do you mean?
The warfare can be really difficult to define, and archaeologists don't always agree on it. And generally speaking, what we are talking about is group violent conflict with the that are at the ends of political cohesion and political gains through different political groups.
And why are you focused on the Missouri River Valley between AD 1000 and 1750?
Part of it just comes in my interest of living along the Missouri River. I grew up in both Pierre and Fargo. And so living along the Missouri River, the villages, the small towns that were occupied during that during those time periods are plain to see. And so I began to wonder about like what the people of the Missouri River lived, how they lived prior to Europeans getting into the area.
So what are the people groups that we are specifically talking about?
Specifically, there are two main groups that are related to the ancestral Mandan and Hidatsa and the ancestral Arikara.
What are you looking for when you are studying this area?
Quite a few things. One is the at the base level are the villages that ancestral Hidatsa, Arikara, Mandan lived in, and so the that shows a bit of the complexity and coordination just to be able to get together in those types of large groups, and looking at both the urbanism that it implies and also the rural areas that are between the villages.
How urban is urban at this time period?
It can vary quite a bit. Give an example for Double Ditch. At the height of Double Ditch, you estimate to 1,300 to 1,400 people, and it can be as small as a few dozen. And those kind of represent more the farming hamlets.
Okay. So when you come across an archaeological site, typically remnants of an old village or possibly of an actual battle scene, how do you even begin that process of breaking down what could have happened and making sure you're not looking at it from an overly 21st century perspective?
A broad question with many answers. A lot of my research is based on pre-existing previous knowledge.
Okay.
So it's reinterpretation of known village sites. What's really amazing about these the villages is that how present they are on the ground surface. In some cases, you walk over them, you don't even know that they're there. But other times, and again, using Double Ditch as an example, you see the houses they lived in, the earth lodges, and the fortification ditch or dry moat where the walls would have been placed. It varies from just being plainly there to buried several meters deep. To address the kind of the oversimplification and this 20th century ideology of what the past is, we really have to rely on a lot of different sources. Some of that is the looking at the archaeological materials themselves,
mm-hmm.
and other is relying on the ethnographic record and what the descendant communities have to say about their past, and really trying to understand it in a first-person perspective.
Well, yeah, when you say that most of your work focuses on reinterpretation, is that mostly because there have been some technological advances that allow for a better understanding or better dating, or is this more in the context of that phrase you just said, the descendant perspective. This might be an understanding in the cultural perspective and broadening that awareness.
I think it's all of the above. The distended perspective has been, at least in my experience with the history of anthropology, has been that from the beginning has been an important aspect of it. Some of the early anthropologists who worked in the area lived with the Mandan, Hidatsa, Arikara communities and really focused on their perspective. But the technology has really enhanced how we map and look at the villages. So things like drone flights have really revolutionized how we map archaeological sites and getting that 3D model perspective. Before that, LIDAR, airborne laser mapping, gave us really fine resolution maps of these locations where you can see the individual houses and the aerial photography that that all combines to be able to look at the site, not just on the ground, but from remotely.
So does that give you a good starting point of this is where I'm going to start digging?
Yes and no.
okay.
So yes, in the sense of traditionally archaeology is focused on excavations. But I say no, in my work, I didn't do a whole lot of digging on for my research. So I relied upon previous excavations and known locations and how these known locations interacted with each other. So it's not just on the individual site, but how the villages worked in a broader landscape.
Well, what do we know about the Mandan, Hidatsa, Arikara relationships at that time? Has that always been a confederacy of these three people groups, or were they at one time warring tribes?
That's a debated topic, and to answer that question, you kind of have to get back to where the first peoples who were the farming villagers in the region, and specifically I'm looking at an area south of Pier and north of Chamberlain and on the Missouri River. The first peoples are around 81,000 are related to the ancestral Mandan and Hidatsa.
Okay.
And you see the first evidence of warfare during that time period with fortified villages. So the villages surrounded by a dry moat and an internal wall. That separates the inside from the outside. But it really intensifies around 12 to 1400 as the ancestral Arikara moved into the region. That was caused by hypothesized that it was a drought in in the Kansas-Nebraska area that forced people to move north. And so the traditional thought is that the ancestral Mandan and ancestral Arikara were the warring parties, and I don't think, and so it kind of has an ethnic warfare slant to the hypothesis. And I think that my research focused on the that those are not the only explanation, and that relationships between people within groups are complex, and the simple idea that people spoke a different language was not the only explanation for conflict in the area.
So elaborate on that. What are some of the other points that you are chasing down?
I looked at the location of villages to each other and the patterns of fortification, and what you see are in some cases. Villages that are supposedly warring, living next to each other without defensible walls. Other times, I think that the is looking at again internally between villages and archaeology uses the term viewshed, but how much they can see from the village location. That type of line of sight is an important aspect for both defense between villages, line of sight views between villages, but also the living space of where. Or outside of the village, where the gardens and people lived and worked, so it's protection of the river bottoms from the village, so that people who are gardening or not also have some protection.
During this time period, and especially these people groups, the nomadic way of life was so important. They were following the food sources. Does that complicate even more how you are able to study warfare and, to a lesser extent, the lifestyle just in general?
It does. I think that one of the problems with Plains village archaeology are the abundance of the villages, and I think that we tend to ignore that there were still mobile hunter-gatherers that are living in the area. And that relationship worldwide between farmers and hunters can always be complicated. Factor in that the farming villagers are also hunting as well. So it creates a lot of resources to kind of tease out within the archaeology.
We're visiting with Dr. Andrew Clark. He is the chief archaeologist for the State Historical Society of North Dakota. He will be presenting Archaeological Perspectives on Warfare on the Great Plains this Tuesday, the 21st at 7 o'clock Central at the North Dakota Heritage Center. And talking about warfare and in this time period and within the people groups that you are looking at, specifically the ancestrals of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara people. And I'm wondering if the word warring or warfare is used in a little bit different context within tribal connections versus when the waves of what's now Europeans came over and the point was near total eradication and stealing of the land. Was the warfare between indigenous people groups to that same level?
Warfare is definitely a loaded term, and it gives us some preconceived notions of value, of good and bad. Mm. There's a couple things important in studying about warfare. One is that, you know, when we use other words like militarism, you start to think about how it is within society. So it's not just about the battle itself, but how you honor the people who fought for protections, the types of things that people do to avoid war. And the other side of the story on that is peace. There's been a lot of literature lately on that, you know, that peace is not easy to do. It's actually – you actively have to choose it.
Yeah.
And so the peace is not just the absence of warfare, and you can actually see that in the archaeology as well. So there are certain ceremonies like the calumet ceremony where it's a making of relatives, and there are artifacts that come from those ceremonies such as Catlinite pipes that are used to participate within those ceremonies. Boiling down to just warfare kind of minimizes the big picture of what it means to a society, and that's kind of one of my goals with my research was to talk about it in a broader sense and learning about people as a stepping stone to learn about how people interact with each other.
Hmm. Were the warriors always male?
Not always. There were mostly there were, but it's there were times when war parties were led by women. It came under certain circumstances that are kind of complex and culturally prescribed.
Do you get into distinctions at all between what warfare looked like between a matriarchal and patriarchal society?
I have not, but there is research to look at that in some cases in a matriarchal society that there is increased warfare. It's kind of counterintuitive, but almost in the sense that it's that the warring societies are have more of a focus rather than the broader leadership.
Yeah, because we like to say things like, you know, before colonization, there wasn't war on this land, or within matriarchal society, there wasn't war. As somebody who studies this, how do you react to statements like that?
When you talk about is there war or is there not war, it really comes down to how you define war and seeing that in the archaeological record, which can be difficult. And so there are certain markers that you look for to differentiate between violence and warfare, like interpersonal violence and warfare.
So how would that show up in the archaeological record?
Sometimes it's difficult, but some of those are through direct evidence, such as artwork. Rock art that shows shield-bearing warriors carrying weapons And sometimes showing the battlefield formations.
Hmm.
Other times is through osteological evidence. People
is that
who
bones?
Bones, yeah,
okay.
Yeah. People through showing people who have died of a violent death. Simply having a wound as the cause of a death doesn't necessarily mean warfare, but when you have mass casualties or repeated stabbings or something along those lines, that the repeated arrow shots that kind of go above and beyond a interpersonal violence. But then also kind of you get look at indirect evidence such as the fortified villages and burning of the villages after a battle. But you have to have some caution with that as well, because there's other reasons for a wall and there's other reasons for burning a village at the end of its life.
Mm. What would be some of those other reasons, like just protecting from a flood?
Well, some of it is a cleansing sense for burning. Mm-hmm. So the
I was thinking the wall.
Absolutely. The protecting from the flood. So would be one of those. And you see that in the Mandan oral tradition as one of the origin stories of a wall surrounding a cedar tree and a protection from the flood. Also, is just a separation of people. The people who live inside the wall and people who live outside the wall.
Sure.
And then with burning, there's a cleansing aspect to it. So as the resources in the area, say the materials needed to build an earth lodge, which is a pretty large amount of wood.
Yeah.
As those are depleting and people move upstream, may have a ceremonial cleansing of the old location.
Yeah. I'm wondering about the role that raiders have played, because it's not uncommon for people to go and raid archaeological sites and steal artifacts, either for just personal use or more likely to sell on the black market. And you're already dealing with this is happening thousands of years ago. This is not a culture that I'm familiar with. And this is not a culture that's been all that well studied relative to the dominant culture. And then you add on to this, maybe somebody stole something that would have provided a little context here.
Yeah, and it's a really important aspect of preservation, because when you're doing that sort of raiding or looting, it's akin to ripping pages out of a book.
Mm.
And so the fewer pages that you have in that book, the more difficult it is to understand the plot. Archaeologists learn about people in the past through context and understand not just the artifacts, but also how they are in association in the ground and where they are found, if they're found within a house or within a storage pit. The point of archaeology or anthropology in general is to understand people. And so it's less of a focus on the object and more of a focus on trying to learn about people in the past.
Well, we've made it more than 15 minutes into this conversation, and we haven't talked about the weather, which I imagine has some advantages and challenges for this kind of work. Let's start with the advantages. Is there an advantage to deep freezing from an archaeological perspective?
As far as on the materials, there are some disadvantages,
okay.
The continual freeze and thaw can cause some damage to the artifacts. But on the work itself, it's winter is actually really calming because we can get writing done. And most archaeologists, say over 95%, do not work in academia, work in a field of cultural resource management. And so when the weather's good, you try to get out as much as possible. And so it's wintertime, provide some time to summarize all the work that you did throughout the summer.
Well, and then I imagine even just working in the field in the summer, North Dakota doesn't have a huge amount of trees.
No, and it's in fact, my favorite time of year to work is about now, like being able to wear long sleeves without boiling, but wear it all day long. And just a comfort of a nice fall walk sometimes is you get the feel of that and see going to places where you normally wouldn't go.
Dr. Andrew Clark is the chief archaeologist for the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Archaeological Perspectives on Warfare on the Great Plains is the name of his presentation. It's coming up on Tuesday, the 21st at 7 o'clock Central at the North Dakota Heritage Center. Dr. Clark, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative. Touchstone Energy Cooperatives comprise a nationwide network of over 730 consumer-owned electric cooperative utilities dedicated to community, integrity, accountability, and innovation.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And as we are starting to transition into fall, it's nice to still see pops of color out there in some of our flowers. In this week's Natural North Dakota, biologist Chuck Lura talks about impatiens.
I recently noticed some impatiens growing among some cattails in Turtle Mountain. It's always a treat to see this interesting plant, also known as jewelweed or touch-me-not. Two species of touch-me-nots are native to North Dakota. The more common and widely distributed species is the spotted touch-me-not, or Impatiens capensis. It can be found roughly east of a line from Bottineau County to Sargent County, along stream banks, springs, and other wet habitats, particularly in wooded areas. Spotted touch-me-not is a much-branched herbaceous annual that grows to around 3 or 4 feet tall. The flowers are about an inch long, sac-like, with a long spur. In combination with orange-yellow color and perhaps some reddish-brown spots, the flowers are interesting and attractive. The common name jewelweed is reportedly a reference to the flowers shimmering in the sunlight like jewels. The name touch-me-not is even more interesting. It's a reference to the explosively dehiscent capsules. As with many dry fruits, the capsules of impatiens break open or dehiss to release the seeds, and they do so in explosive fashion. When the fruits are mature, a simple touch of the hand, or to be more effective, a pinch, can cause the fruits to explode open, sending seeds flying in all directions. As you can imagine, this can lead to some fun entertainment. Another interesting aspect of impatiens is the production of seeds from flowers that don't require pollination. Botanists call the phenomenon cleistogamy, and the flowers are said to be cleistogamous. These small flowers, which may be produced at the base of some of the leaves, are about a 1/16 of an inch long and inconspicuous. Impatiens was used medically by many Native American tribes. The mucilaginous sap from the stems and leaves was used to treat various skin conditions and to treat exposure to poison ivy and stinging nettle. It's still used by herbalists. So as you travel about, be on the lookout for some tall, bushy plants sporting lots of orange-colored flowers in wet areas. It could be spotted touch-me-not. And if there are some fruits, try giving them a pinch. I've put a couple of pictures of spotted touch-me-not along with the text of this Natural North Dakota. You can access it at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. Subscribe to the podcast or find past episodes at prairiepublic.org.
Still to come on Main Street, have a plethora of vegetables right now? Sue Balcom can help. But now, this news.
Good afternoon from the Prairie Public Newsroom. I'm Todd McDonald. Students in the Fargo Public School District will soon be able to be tested for COVID-19 without taking a special trip to the clinic or testing site. Fargo Public Schools is preparing to launch an in-school COVID-19 testing program. Each school will have a scheduled time during the day when Bionax Now rapid testing will be available. The testing will be offered to students and staff. According to school officials, if a student or staff member has an unmasked close contact, they can use the testing program to remain in school. The student or staff member must test at least every other day and remain asymptomatic during the duration of the testing program. Parents who want to enroll their children in the program must complete an online testing consent form. A start date for the testing program is still being determined. Amazon is preparing to have employees working at its massive fulfillment center in North Fargo Sunday. Construction has been underway for more than a year. General Manager John Sabo says the more than 1 million square foot warehouse could hold 22 football fields.
We are striving to be kind of the employer of choice, right? And we have a wide variety of benefits packages to strive that. We also have an on-site recruiting center connected to the building so that our local recruiting team can really provide the best view of what the job entails. And that's what we want to do. I mean, Fargo has incredibly low unemployment right now, and I think that's fantastic, right? And we just want to continue to help, one, be a good community partner, and two, provide opportunities for whoever wants them.
Amazon has an aggressive recruitment program underway with the eventual goal of 1,400 employees. The center will primarily serve customers in North Dakota and South Dakota, as well as Minnesota. The target date for the first shipments from Fargo is October 1st. Amazon also has a last-mile delivery terminal in West Fargo, which is expected to provide another 100 jobs. And Minnesota organized labor leaders are pressing state lawmakers to resolve their differences over a $250 million plan to assist pandemic frontline workers. The unions blame Republicans for trying to exclude many of the workers, but Republicans say the money only goes so far, and they want those who are most at risk to be the first in line. Renee Wong of United Food and Commercial Workers wants lawmakers to include all essential workers and find more money to do it.
The working group and the legislature should act on an equitable plan to distribute at least this amount and expand the fund to compensate workers who put their lives at risk and continue to do so every day.
The panel charged with crafting a plan to spend the money did not meet a deadline last week because of disagreements. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and you can get lost in a great book, and it can transport you to another world. But a truly wonderful piece of work can also inspire change. In this Postcards from the Prairie, essayist Eliza Blue talks about her love of the book Black Beauty.
In 1877, a young woman named Anna Sewell published a book called Black Beauty, The Autobiography of a Horse. The book has since sold 50 million copies in 50 languages worldwide and is considered to be one of the most popular books of all time. Anna meant her book to be a call to action for the improved treatment of horses. By framing Black Beauty's story as an autobiography, readers were moved to empathize with the horse's struggles and mistreatment at the hand of humans. It worked, and the result was legislative and societal change. Now, one of those 50 million copies was purchased for my mother when she was a child. She read and reread the story many times, staying up too late on summer nights, engrossed in a tale from a time when horses still pulled cabs and carts, and self-propelling automobiles were a figment of the collective imagination. Later, she read the book to her own children, and I loved the story too, though it broke my heart. I vowed one day to have a horse of my own who I would protect and honor and would love me and I would love back. A few stints at horse camp and a few trail rides while on vacation were as close as I got until I came to live here on the ranch. I was ecstatic at the prospect of getting to know the horses here, certain it was the beginning of a relationship I had been waiting for most of my life, based solely on the impression that Black Beauty had given me. Namely, that horses were just like humans, only better. Imagine my surprise the first time you discovered that horses can be real jerks, especially to one another. Bring a new horse into an established pack, and the pack will make schoolyard bullying look like a kindness. They bite, they kick, they chase, they scream at the newcomer as everyone tries to figure out how best to integrate the interruption to group life. Horses can be equally obnoxious to humans, although thankfully they usually aren't. We humans aren't part of their social fabric, so it's less important to show dominance in our presence. However, I've seen plenty of horses that will buck or squeal or run away at the first sight of a bridle, or generally make life difficult for their riders. Black Beauty's endless obedience and willingness to serve are not, it turns out, a universal trait in horses. Yes, with training, they will let us saddle them and ride around on their backs, and they will go where we lead them, which I don't mean to devalue because that is pretty cool, especially when they outweigh us by so much. But it's by no means a seamless love affair. Or anyway, that's my takeaway after 7 years of ranch horses that I have tried to make love me, but like so many of the men I dated in my 20s, have in turn made it very clear they'd rather hang out with their friends. This week, a new horse came to live on our ranch. He is mostly black with a white blaze on his beautiful long nose and one white sock. The exact physical attributes Anna gave her eponymous character. He is a stranger to the rest of the horses, so we haven't put him out into the pasture yet, instead letting everyone assess the situation with the safety of fences separating them. I visit him in the warm twilight. The little kid part of my brain is still waiting to meet my new best friend. The adult part of me knows better. He is bored and hot, swatting flies with his tail and stopping to shake them off his legs. He lets me pet him, but only if I have oats. Relationships with horses, just like all relationships, grow and change over time. I am not this horse's salvation, and he is not mine. But that doesn't mean we won't be friends. Learning to trust the other's good intentions over 1,000 evenings of snacks and quiet dusks.
Eliza Blue is a South Dakota writer and musician. After years on the road as a traveling musician, she now practices regenerative agriculture, raising fiber sheep and grass-fed cattle with her husband and 2 children. You can visit her at ElizaBlueMusic.com. Sue Balcom is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Hey, lifelong learner. Humanities North Dakota is featuring Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Eli Saslow, author of Rising Out of Hatred. This event will explore the rise of white nationalism and political polarization in contemporary America and point toward overcoming divisions and hatred. Information and registration can be found at humanitiesnd.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me from our Bismarck studio is root cellar Sue. Sue Balcom joins us once a week from her farm outside of Mandan, the root cellar's farm, to talk about food. Sue, thanks as always for joining us.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
We are either kind of in or coming up on root vegetable season.
True.
And a lot of other good vegetables. I mean, I've been up to my ears in tomatoes for weeks now, but we've got carrots and beets and squash coming up.
Peppers, onions, you name it. Like, there seems to be a couple weeks here in early September where there's just about anything you could imagine. And farmers markets should be going. Ours goes till the end of October because we like to totally make sure that our pumpkins and squash get a little frosted and then they're actually better. But yes, go to your farmers market and load up your refrigerators with vegetables. And then I was asked the other day about a Facebook post that I made, which is why I'm going to talk a little bit about being creative in the kitchen with these vegetables and making main meal dishes that would be strictly, well, I guess they'd be vegetarian because I don't add much more than bacon to a lot of these recipes.
That is not vegetarian.
Okay, well, I'm pretending. I use a lot of meat for flavoring, but I don't necessarily care to have a lot in anything. But what you need to do is just plan ahead a little bit and then get well-versed in pie crusts or buy them, I suppose. You could buy pie crusts, frozen pie crusts, phyllo pastry, yeast doughs, and then shortbreads or short doughs like you would make Irish soda bread out of, because then you have a base, basically, for just about any combination of any of these vegetables that you could possibly want. So this little conversation on Facebook started out with what I made one night for dinner, which was a tomato pie. I've been wanting to do this for so long. And I make, when I make pie crust, I take, this is part of being able to cook for yourself all week long, even if you have a job, is just kind of being a little bit organized and a little prepared.
Yeah.
Now, we were at my brother's house over Labor Day weekend, and my son was with me. And he walks through the kitchen, and he stops in front of the whiteboard that's leaning against the canisters on the counter, and he goes, "Is this for real?" And my brother's like, "Yeah, it is." Because then I know what we plan the menu out every week. And so Adam's reading off this menu and he's like, "I'm staying down here this week." They were having fajitas and they were having, you know, whatever. But then they plan their menus out and then that way they can get the meat thawed that they need to make a certain recipe or get something from the grocery store.
Right. And it's nice when you have an excess of one.
Right.
Particular ingredient that you sort of have three or four that don't taste all of the same, but use a lot of the same ingredients.
Right. Because you can kind of like, and I learned that from working in the restaurant in Gackle.
Yeah.
That lady I worked for was masterful at serving something on Sunday and then transforming it all week long into other dishes. So on the weekends when I have time, I will mix up pie crusts and I will put them, separate them into a bottom crust and a top crust, wrap them up real good and put them in my freezer and take them out one or two at a time. Or if I'm doing the market, I'll take out the whole batch at once. So I thought, oh, I have these spare pie crusts that I'm not going to use to bake pie because I'm lazy. And I took one out and I made this tomato pie and it was so stinking
good. So I'm guessing kind of a savory pie, right?
Totally. That's okay. It was our main dish. And so all you do is you roll out a pie crust. And then you spread some butter on it because you want the pie crust to be so the tomatoes don't soak into the bottom crust.
Oh, sure.
But also, if you put down a layer of grated Parmesan cheese on top of that butter, that will also help you with the barrier.
Yeah.
And then you don't have to be a pie maker to do these wonderful vegetable pies. You just kind of like slice those tomatoes about a quarter of an inch thick and don't slice them horizontally because then your guts fall out. So you slice them the vertical way.
Okay.
And then lay them down. You can overlap them. You can put them in not so thick, but make sure that you've got most of the pie crust covered. Leave about 2.5 inches around the outside edge. And then I thought, well, if the tomatoes are going to be good like this, a little salt and pepper and whatever spices you want to throw on there, then a little bacon fried mushrooms would make it even better. And so I took a couple slices of bacon and I sauteed a bunch of mushrooms and I threw that over the top. And then you simply, here was my mistake. I did this on my butcher block. Put it on a piece of parchment paper when you're rolling it out so you can get it off your butcher block without folding it in half. But you just simply put your ingredients down and then fold the outside edges up. And they can overlap here and there. It can tear here or there. But just kind of like tuck them over, leaving the center of the pie exposed. And then put it in a 400-degree oven for 20 minutes. Then you can add grated mozzarella or more Parmesan or grated cheddar on the top until that's all bubbly. I'm telling you, it was a fit for a king.
So there are salsa tomatoes, sauce tomatoes, burger tomatoes. What kind of tomato is best for a tomato pie?
I would probably try for a Roma or a plum tomato, something that's got a little more meat and a little less juice in it.
Okay.
Let's see. What are the Amish paste? Those are the ones that I grow. And so, but I added a couple other ones in there, and really, it did not soak through to the pie crust. And I mean, it was divine. Like, we almost ate that whole thing that night.
I can see that. Yeah.
So, think about having some pie crusts around, and you could do this with caramelized onions and cheese and bacon, or you could do it if you like. I love peppers, roasted peppers on the grill. You know, you char them and put them in a bag and then you take the skins off. I think the reason people don't like peppers is because the skins are bitter. And so if you char them on the grill and get rid of those skins, you have lovely, flavorful peppers. And I have 3 or 4 different colors of peppers, which would make it even prettier. than just using regular green peppers. I like red peppers a lot.
If you're going to be mixing in other veggies, is there kind of a rule of thumb for you want to be cooking certain vegetables a little bit before adding them to the pie crust?
Excellent question there. Yes, peppers are, well, unless you really soften them up on the grill, peppers are a little bit harder. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's just kind of like, if you don't mind the crunch, I like crunchy vegetables. You know, I really don't mind when something is a little bit underdone
right.
in the vegetable
But
department.
If it's like a big chunk of squash,
right.
you need
and,
to.
And if
that's
I was
not crunchy, that's just not cooked.
Right, right. And I wouldn't use squash on a pie crust.
Okay.
But I might use squash as a puree to make a muffin or, oh my gosh, I found this recipe for roasted carrot tea loaf. You know, everybody's making squash bread and zucchini bread mm-hmm. and applesauce bread, but this recipe calls for carrots and you roast them because anytime you roast a vegetable, it's going to get caramelized the sugars in there and it's going to get sweeter and softer. And we eat a lot of just plain old roasted vegetables, but you could also roast your vegetables before you throw them on the top of a pie crust. And let's say you don't want to make pie. You could do a lot of these things with pizza crusts or naan bread, N-A-A-N, mm-hmm. you know, naan bread.
Mm-hmm.
That we had a friend that used to do that, roll them out, and he'd grill one side of the bread and then slip sheet them with wax paper and put them in the freezer. So you want pizza, you bring the pizza out or bring the naan bread out. You put whatever you want on the grilled side, then take it out to your grill and grill it till it's done again. Yummy. And those are simple meals that you can make if you have your ingredients, few ingredients stashed away in your freezer and you remember to thaw them out in the morning. It's really easy to make use of all these wonderful vegetables that you have in the garden right now.
Earlier, you said that on the weekends you try to stockpile pie crusts and you put them in different piles. One's a bottom crust, one is a top crust. What is the difference between a bottom crust and a top crust?
The size.
Oh, okay.
You know, when you put a bottom pie crust in, it has to crawl up the sides of your pie plant, so it's usually a little bit bigger. But if you cut them in half, the best part about making pie is the scraps that have the cinnamon sugar on, and you bake those in the oven to, you know, test whether your pie crust is good.
Yeah, make sure you're not poisoning yourself.
Totally awesome. Now, here's a pie that my mom used to make for us when we were kids. And she would make a pie crust. And I have the pan that she used to make this in. It's a fluted pan and it's really deep. And so she'd put the bottom crust in there. And then she would put fry sausage that's been crumbled and potatoes and onions and maybe a few carrots if she had them. And then a little bit of grease like butter or lard. I suppose it could be Crisco, but we used to use lard and butter a lot. Then put the top crust on, and it was like the German-Russian version of a chicken pot pie. Mm. And it was really good. The only thing that I think would have made it better would have been gravy. Gravy on the top. So, okay, so let's very quickly visit yeast breads. You know, everybody's been baking sourdough. And if you have sourdough starter and you mix up your bread dough and you can leave it in the refrigerator overnight or you can leave it on the counter during the day. And when you come home from work, you can roll that out and you can take like cherry tomatoes or, you know, peppers, once again, peppers on the grill, some onions. You can make yourself a really nice pizza out of sourdough crust, you know, and it doesn't have to be thin. It doesn't have to be thick. It can be whatever it is, just as long as it carries those wonderful vegetables to your mouth.
And is that one where you'd still want to be baking it in the oven, or could you almost pan fry that on the stove?
Oh, I never tried the pan frying idea, but I have seen recipes for things like that. I'm going to have to experiment this weekend with that.
All right. Well, you get back to us.
I will. But yeah, you could grill it too. You could grill a sourdough pizza, or if you had a husband that built you a nice brick pizza oven, that would be the perfect
situation.
Are
you listening, JC?
But yeah, I have this little, you know, the two oven I have two ovens, one's what we call the pizza oven that heats up to 400 or 450 degrees quite quickly. And I bake a lot of this stuff at a higher temperature than, you know, like my mom baked everything at 350. But one of the things that sets it apart is really high heat. Mm-hmm. So let's say you're making biscuits. They definitely need to be put in a really hot oven, and then that gives it a spring. When I bake sourdough bread in a loaf pan, I will put it in at a 400 degrees rather than 350 so that it springs and bakes. It bakes better that way when you have less eggs and milk in your dough. Now, if you're doing a sweeter dough, you want to bake it at a lower temperature. But there's focaccia dough that you can make and use cherry tomatoes and all kinds of things that will serve as a base for making a vegetarian type meal, you know, very quickly. It takes a half an hour to roll something out and stick the vegetables on and away we go.
Everything pizzas.
Yeah, and cheese. Definitely get some good quality cheese to use, both on the bottom of your crust and on the top of your crust.
We're mostly have been talking about making savory pies with these vegetables. Are there a couple of good sweet options for some of the things that are showing up in the gardens and the farmers markets right now, but still veggie?
Well, actually, yes, because let me think now. If we were to use squash or carrots or beets, you can make raised breads or muffins out of those ingredients by, of course, roasting them in the oven. You'll roast your carrots or roast your beets, boil your beets if you have to skin them first. Peeling cold beets or peeling beets is difficult. So
it's not.
Well, I make a raw beet salad and I'm like, God, this is so much more work.
I mean, it's messy.
It is messy. And I always wear gloves because, yeah, definitely. So those ingredients pureed would make great additions to any kind of sweet breads that you're making or muffins that you're making. And I have to tell you, one of my favorite books, and that's where most of my ideas and recipes come from, it's called The Harvest Baker, and I've mentioned it before, by Ken Heidrich. And the recipes in here are superb. Some of them are large enough for, you know, company coming. You can make a slab pie for company, or you can make just one tiny little tomato pie for yourself if you so choose. But there's cornbread. There's that you can use corn off the cob, you know, because corn season has come maybe and gone by now. It was such a tough year for corn.
Yeah.
Our growers just had a really, really tough time with corn this year. So whatever we got definitely was irrigated corn because we just didn't get any water. And, you know, most of these crusts that I talk about, you know, pie crust or focaccia or any kind of raised bread dough, you can easily find recipes for these that you can make pie crust or anything in a food processor. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, your raised and sweet breads you can make with your mixer. So it's not a lot of work, but I think it just takes a little bit of thought. And one of the reasons I think have so much activity when I post something like this on Facebook. Everybody wants the recipe. Everybody wants to know how to do it. Some of our restaurants have limited hours anymore. Some of them are closed on certain days of the week because they're so short of help in this area. And so one of these days, everybody's probably going to have to cook a couple days at home. And so I would definitely recommend reviewing some of these techniques and going to your farmer's market and taking advantage of the last of the beautifulest fall vegetables before the winter vegetables like cabbage and pumpkins and squash and that kind of stuff show up. The heavy stuff.
Good advice. We check in with Sue Balcom once a week. Thank you, Sue.
Hey, thanks, Ashley.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Climate change is driving more powerful hurricanes and more frequent storms. One city in Louisiana got hit by four disasters in just 1 year.
It's just me trying to figure out, how am I going to do this again tomorrow?
What can regular citizens do when the government's response to disaster falls short? Check out our new documentary, In Deep, One City's Year of Climate Chaos, from APM.
In Deep, this week's Prairie Public Presents, coming up Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 16th. In 1917, laws governing what could happen on Sundays, the Blue Laws, seemed to be on the brink of change in North Dakota. But many of those bills failed, including a bill allowing shooting and hunting on Sundays. Few paid the law much mind until it was reported that the law would be enforced. The Grand Forks Herald said, some 60,000 city sportsmen who have little chance to hunt except on Sunday apparently did not awake to the fact that the last legislature had more or less specifically prohibited this sport until an oral opinion came from the office of Attorney General Langer to the effect that the ban on Sunday shooting would be enforced. People guilty of breaking the Sabbath laws were punishable by fine and possibly time in the county jail. However, a Cass County court case challenging the law came before the state Supreme Court. A.F. Davis had been convicted of breaking the Sabbath in August after he and a private hunting party of one or more persons went hunting for crows. The opinion handed down by the court was thus: nothing is said of the kind or character or number of crows shot, or as to whether they were bad crows or good crows. So the charge against the defendant is based on an old Sunday statute as it has stood on the books during 52 years. By its plain words, the statute refers to and prohibits only public shooting and other public sports. The shooting charged against Davis was a private sport. It was not done in such a way as to attract a crowd of people or to injure or offend any person. It was a mere private diversion. The judgment was reversed, and Davis was discharged. The case had been fast-tracked so the decision could arrive prior to the start of the hunting season. Attorney General Langer sent notice of the decision to the deputy game warden, noting that it is immaterial as to whether a chicken or a crow is shot. The decision, in my opinion, makes it lawful for private hunting parties to hunt prairie chickens or other game on Sunday. So, bird hunting season started on this date in 1917. As reported by the Fargo Forum and Daily Republican, North Dakota sportsmen have the permission of the Supreme Court to shoot their heads off. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Sarah Walker. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we think of things like roads as infrastructure, and we take them every day on the way to work, right? Well, what about something like daycare, which a lot of people need in order to work? We ponder the idea of daycare as infrastructure. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.